First of all, let me thank the organizers for the opportunity to participate and speak in such a stimulating conference. As you noticed, the title is slightly different from what I had advertised. This is just a short follow-up on what Chris discussed about work by two brilliant people, Brian Chen and Nitin Upadhyaya. It pertains the behavior of a toy. A toy introduced by Charlie Kane and Sid Nagel. No, sorry, Charlie Kane and Tom Lubanski. Sorry. No, it's different. I'm going to try to illustrate what this toy is about because it's a good introduction to what I'm going to talk about. As Chris pointed out in his talk, these are mechanical systems that display zero energy edge mode in terms of Fanonic degrees of freedom. You can see that there's a zero energy edge mode because I can replace all the spring in the system by rigid struts. This motion doesn't stretch any springs. The peculiarity is that despite the two edges are equivalent in terms of local constraint counting, this one moves, but this one doesn't. Okay? The phenomenon is not local. The second thing, and that's why it's important to understand that it's an analog of topological insulators, is that nothing in the bulk moves. People who do solid-state physics, they will say that this system is gapped. Okay? This is an analog of topological insulator displaying mechanical edge states here. When I first saw this, I said, "Well, okay, that may well be true. This is an insulator, but these modes cost zero energy." Together with Brian and Nitin, we said, "What happens if you tilt this chain? That is to say, you push the zero mode with an infinitesimal perturbation." You see, the zero mode moves from one end to the other. In other words, something which is an insulator in linear theory becomes a conductor by means of propagating solitary waves, pretty much in the physics like a polyacetylene. Now, for those of you who have been fond of soft mode and zero modes in the context of jamming, you will see a little bit of connection in what comes out in the rest of the talk. Let me just say that if you're interested in how this can be modeled mathematically in terms of nonlinear field theory, which admit inhomogeneous solution capable of describing this kink, you can read this paper where we explain that the physics of this chain can be described by theories with a topological boundary term that is responsible for this. What that means in practice is that unlike the shocks that you're going to hear in my talk in the next, here the shock can be excited from this edge, but not from this edge. There's a sense of directionality to propagation, which is this topological invariant that Chris was talking about in the linear theory, but it can be standard in a nonlinear theory and in an homogeneous system as well. What I do want to talk about, which is related, is shocks and failure in fragile solids. The similarity between what I was describing is that what I described was a strongly nonlinear chain, not too different from granular medium. Yes, it displays dynamics out of equilibrium. Equilibrium cannot even be defined in this out-thermal system. But the media that I'm going to describe today also add an extra ingredient of difficulty, which is disorder. And so my passion scientifically are problems that lie in this sort of Bermuda Triangle of difficulties. And yesterday, Professor Langer, in his birthday speech, gave a passionate encouragement to go into that triangle, even if that means losing the mathematical beauty that we all cherish. And so in that spirit, I will try to do that. And they've been a companion in this journey from which I've learned a lot, starting from PhD student of mine, like Thomas and Nitin, brilliant postdocs like Brian Chen, Stefan Urich, colleagues like Maha. And also, more recently, I had the opportunity of starting working again with one of my postdoctoral mentors, Professor Nagel from the University of Chicago. And not only in the context of simulation, which is what we had done before, but also in the context of experiment, beautifully done by Michelle Driscoll. And in the context of fracture, I'm just going to show you both of them together. But first of all, let me tell you in just one line, what is this talk about? This talk is about studying things like sound and fracture, cracks, which are typical of solids, which are defined by their rigidity, close to a critical point where that rigidity is lost. a critical point at which linear sound wave doesn't exist, a critical point at which cracks cannot propagate. And we can approach that critical point continuously, both in experiment and simulation, and I want to show you what happens. And I hope also to stimulate some of the experimentalists in the audience to attempt trying some of these things at home. Okay, so the first thing, and of course I'm going to show some of the pictures, especially the younger guys. So this is Stefan, and this is Nitin. And so this is the beginning. So here we first start studying sound. And our first thought was this. If you take a granular packing of the same type that Corey and his collaborators studied back then, and you say at a finite pressure, you can replace all the particle in contacts by force. And if they replace this force by a spring whose length is adjusted in such a way they will not be stretched, you can get a network. And this network, depending on the pressure of the original packing, will have a certain coordination number, Z, defined as the number of bonds that come out of each node. Okay? And if that number is above 4 in two dimensions for central forces, you're rigid, assuming there's no friction, etc. If you're below, the structure is floppy. And so you have a natural control parameter that tells you how you lose rigidity in the system, which is the distance Z minus ZC, which we call delta Z. And I should say, if you didn't want to make it that way, but you just take a highly coordinated network and you randomly cut, you will still have a point where you lose rigidity. But the peculiar thing of doing this way is just that you have essentially the shear modulus going to zero linearly in delta Z. If you did it with another preparation procedure, you would have an exponent here, which is a little bit different. But in both cases, at this point, the shear modulus is zero. Okay? Please notice that the spring constant of the harmonic spring is not zero. So that's different from granular media where you have a nonlinear interaction between particles. But the way I would like to say it is that there is a bare elastic constant K, but then there is also a collective elastic constant, which is mediated by the control parameter. Same thing will happen for the viscosity, because in this medium, in this simulation that you're going to see, we put also dissipative forces that depend on the relative velocity between these two particles. And here, too, there is a coefficient, the bare coefficient of viscosity, of dissipation, but there will also be a coefficient in front of the stress-strain relationship. We want to figure out how that depends on dz, for example. And so we said, okay, the shear speed of sound, the linear speed of sound, this is square root of g. If z equals zero, if delta z is equal to zero, g is equal to zero. So linear speed of sound, transverse direction, is zero. But if I try to shear this, do I see a front moving or not? So you see why this is all about studying transients. But transients can last a very long time in systems with slow dynamics. So what you see here, colored in yellow, is the velocity in the y direction. So here the particles are moving, here they're not. And there is a shear front, which is rather sharp, that separates the two. It clearly moves. And one question that you can ask is, or two questions is, what sets its speed and what sets its width? Okay? Roughly speaking, one tells you about the elasticity and the other about the dissipative process that takes place in this medium.
What's the color code?
So it's for the velocity in the y direction of the particle. So here nothing moves and here things move. Okay? And so in a sense, we're studying the transient of establishing a uniform shear across the material. Okay? And so so we said, okay, let's perform a bunch of simulation for different amount of shear strain, which is defined as the derivative in the y direction of dx, and different delta z. So let me show you some preliminary things there. First of all, notice that you can extract from the numerics profile of this velocity, okay? And you can see how this profile evolves in time. And that's where you extract this information from, after doing a lot of leverage, of course. Okay? So this position here is the position of the front, say, at that point of time. Okay, well, here's what we did. We said we're going to measure the velocity of the front as a function of gamma, starting first very far away from the critical point. And what you see, characteristic and somewhat boring of linear physics, is that that velocity doesn't depend much on gamma. But as gamma is increased, you approach a second regime. And the point of approach goes to lower and lower strains as you go to the critical point. The chain that I just showed you, which is an isostatic system in the bulk, any infinitesimal deformation will move the soliton and the shocks. Here, the same question, the same thing is achieved by going all the way to the critical point. And notice that you look at this and say, well, it's a little bit messy. Why don't we try to plot all this data on a single master curve? This is usually the beginning of an understanding. And so you say, well, if this is the velocity of linear sound, then it's just the square root of delta z. So let me just plot things in terms of vf over the linear speed of sound, and then let me rescale this axis by whatever allows me to bring this crossover point on the same line, on the same position. And what you find is this. Now, this curve is less messy. In fact, there's only two things, the linear regime and the nonlinear regime. Okay. How this scales is just the square root of the shear modulus. There's only two things that we need to understand to zero order, which is the slope here in the nonlinear regime, and second, what sets the crossover, which, as you can see already from the numerics, seems to be delta z. And in order to do that, and of course, I mean, just symbolically, you can see here, and if you looked at my computer, there's a shaded yellow line here that separates the linear waves from the nonlinear shock waves domain. And now, if you want to understand where this and this come from, you have to know something about the nonlinear stress-strain relationship of this medium. And of course, in jamming and isostatic networks, these things have been studied fairly well, but these are non-trivial results. I recommend this paper by my friend Mathieu Guyard. And what you can see here, there's a stress proportional to a strain with a proportionality g that will go to zero. But there's also a nonlinear term with a pretty funny shape, non-analytic, incidentally. And so what one trick that you can figure out, you can say, well, let me define an effective shear modulus by dividing everything by gamma. And so this effective shear modulus is the linear part plus the part that depends on the strain itself. At the critical point, or above a certain threshold given by the ratio between this and this, which goes like delta z, only this term will be important, which means, which means that the velocity will go like gamma to the power of 1/2, because it's simply the square root of the shear modulus, or the effective shear modulus, the nonlinear correction. Yeah, because that's not a perturbative result in Taylor series. And let me get to this in the discussion, because this is a talk on its own. That's why doing this thing is not a trivial thing. And I would encourage, for example, an experimentalist who wanted to figure that out could have performed this experiment without knowing anything about the stress-strain relation and inferred it from it. And to be honest, when I first read the paper by Mathieu, I didn't believe it either. And so I wanted to test it. Okay. And you also see how this comes, because since this doesn't depend on delta z, you compare this and this, and the nonlinear part wins above strains that go like delta z. Okay. Now, okay, this is seems like a simple story, more or less. This is a story of the velocity at the front. How about the story of the width of the front? That must depend on dissipative effects. And so you can try to model that also by writing down this very simple equation. There's a coefficient of viscosity here. And one thing that you want to know is how does it depend on the distance from the critical point as well, besides the prefactor. And so one thing we did, we said, OK, let's just do the same thing. And we looked at all the profile as a function of time. And of course, one smart thing to do is just, since you have this viscosity, you typically expect diffusive broadening of the shock front. And so perhaps the best thing to do is to plot the width squared divided by time. Okay? And when you do that, you can see in this plot that at very high delta z, the front is very sharp, but very close to the critical point, like this yellow line, this yellow here, it becomes very, very broad. And another thing that surprised me a little bit is that I just took this equation and I wrote down the corresponding equation of motion, which I didn't expect to work in such a complicated system with all the non-affine displacement. And the lines that you find here fitting the data are coming from that. Okay? So you can then say, well, what is this coefficient then? Extracted by plotting width squared over time. And what you find is it does depend on delta z, But in that, it depends on delta z with this coefficient of minus 1. Okay, exponent of minus 1, sorry. Okay. So this is the result that you obtain. Okay. And of course, all this stuff is done for gamma much less than gamma c. That's to say, small strain, such that you've not entered yet, we'll do it later, the nonlinear regime. Okay? Because the nonlinear regime is controlled by the physics of the critical point. At the critical point, you don't know about delta z. The scaling only exists in the linear regime. Okay? But I look at, you look at this and you say, where is it coming from? And why does such a simple continuum equation can possibly describe this? And so the surprise was perhaps even greater, because we know that in this system, non-affine deformation are crucial. And non-affine deformation are not described by these simple fields that describe only the affine part. So what is a non-affine deformation? I think Itamar gave a very learned presentation. And this paper is also a fantastic place to start. I'll just do it visually. I'll first show you what an affine deformation is by shearing this network, which leaves very far above the critical point. And please notice that as you move the top and the bottom in this direction, more or less all the other in between follow. Okay? Okay? There's no many that follow that move in the opposite direction, for example, in the perpendicular direction. Now, just visually, to understand the math that Itamar presented, imagine doing it very close to this point. Okay? And just see the same thing visually. You'll see a lot of this events. Okay? This motion is clearly not described by this equation. So when we write this equation, that I allegedly, well, allegedly is true, I tell you the truth, gives you these wonderful curves fitting the data, I'm ignoring the non-affine part of the shear field. And moreover, I know from the work of some of my friends before that the non-affine part over the affine one, as you approach the critical point, diverges. Now, that looks like a very stupid thing to do. You split the field in two parts, one which is bigger than the other, and you call this the perturbation, and this your field. It's very perverse, okay? But there's a logic in that perversion when it works, which I would say is a form of poor man renormalization. Let me try to highlight the, you can consider, and this ties up a little bit with Jim Langer's talk yesterday, this non-affine deformation as a sort of heat bath towards which the kinetic energy that you try to pump in the affine deformation will inevitably and irreversibly leak. Okay? So you can ignore the non-affine deformation provided that your choice of this dissipation coefficient is chosen in such a way that it properly captures this divergent leakage into the non-affine deformation. To show you that this is not just words, let me show you how you do that simple thing. If you were honest, you would look at this and you would say, there's a coefficient of dissipation eta naught, which is order one. And then there is a non-affine displacement field, which is very large, and that's responsible for the dissipation. Okay? And that this term goes like the square of this, when measured in the units of gamma, which is scales like one over delta z. Instead, what we're saying, because we insist on using continuum elasticity, is to say we're going to express our answer for the dissipation in terms of the gamma, which is the affine part, which is order one. But if you want this to match that, you have to choose your effective viscosity of the medium to go like one delta z. Here is the trick. You shuffle the funny behavior that the field, the fluctuation in the field do, into a coefficient, and you make it larger and larger. Okay, so there's an amplification of the viscosity due to a parameter that has to do with geometry, which measure the importance of the non-affine deformation.
Okay. To do that, you need some separation of timescales or something?
Yes, because essentially this non-affine motion is very fast compared to that scale at which the front moves. The front is well-defined. The fact that you have a well-defined front is why you can do it. Yeah.
Well,
Yeah. So it's even more. I think what I would have, so you can take any display. I think the question, if I may phrase it in my language, is are these motions that I'm calling the erratic motions I'm ignoring a simple non-affine deformation, or is something more, because they correspond to what looks like buckling events? So this is actually a good point, in my opinion, because a non-affine deformation can still be reversible. But if these things happen, this non-affine deformation is irreversible, and then I think one has the right of considering it as...
But what you were saying, non-affine, I think what you're saying now, can you use those non-affine, it's irreversible?
Shall I get you the speaker?
That's the question, period.
This is more interesting than the monologue.
Instant clarification. I think what you mean is the irreversible pieces.
Although
not just the ordinary, non-affine.
Right, but the way you detect them operationally is you take the affine part and you take it out.
Yeah, well, that's a nice trick.
In the same way as in your talk, you showed how to detect the STZ in the original Michael calculation.
Yeah,
by the end.
But look, I think we got the point.
Yes. But it's crucial that it's irreversible. Otherwise, we couldn't portray it as a heat bath in which you leak. So that's why I thought it was an interesting connection with your talk. Yes. Okay. May I ask you to keep in mind this? Because you see, this is a bit of a dynamical effect. But if you look at these things in real space, you see the width of a kink diverging with a characteristic length scale that goes like delta z to the minus 1/2. The situation is reminiscent of critical phenomena, in which you can pick up a divergent length scale, either from two-point correlation function or from the divergence of the magnetic domain wall. Okay? And I would like you to keep this in mind when we look at the fracture, because in the fracture we're going to see some reminiscence of this physics. Now, there's one thing that is particularly scary, especially when you have to stop at a certain time. Here is written a long times. So this is something that you attain in the asymptotic state. A question is always legitimate to ask is, how long is long? Okay. In particular, something that is a bit disheartening this problem is that there's a characteristic time scale in here, which is given by the ratio of g over eta. Eta over g. And eta goes like 1 delta z, g goes like delta z. So there's a characteristic time scale that is diverging. Okay. And you could ask, if you don't have all the time in the universe, what are you going to be seeing? Okay, so we performed that, and we looked at how the width increases as a function of time. This is width squared, as a function of time. And you see, yes, at very long time, there is this diffusive broadening with this coefficient. But at early times, there is a super diffusive broadening. And the important thing is that the crossover between the two, it's a time scale that goes to infinity at the critical point, which means that at the critical point, forget about watching this. You'll only see this. Okay? In the same way as at the critical point, you don't see a linear front, but only shocks. These shocks will be broadening super diffusively. And you know, when I talk with my experimental friend about this, I try to sell it to them as shear front rheology, meaning in a system with slow dynamics, you look at this transient, and you try to infer the oscillatory rheology. So how do you do it? The question is, how does this 3/2 is related to oscillatory rheology? Okay? And the answer is simple, and I found very inspirational to look at this paper by Brian. What Brian did, Tighe did oscillatory rheology. And what he finds is that above a certain frequency scale that matches this time scale in the inverse, the oscillation is too fast to depend only on delta z. But it depends on the frequency at which you're oscillating with this power law. That means that if you do the simple poor man formula for w squared linear in t, which is diffusion, if this quantity itself depends on omega, which means that it depends also on time with a 1/2, then you get a t to the 3/2. One part which comes from here and the other part which comes from there. And here is this slope. So you can read from the speed of the super diffusive broadening of the shocks the oscillatory rheology of your media. Okay? So the bottom line of the story is, at the critical point, sound propagated by supersonic shock waves broadening superdiffusive. Okay? Now, this is a story. You can read it. There's a bit more in there. The question that we wanted to ask was initially in simulation, and then I'll show you also the experimental part, but we really made a team to study all of this together, is what happens if in the same way as you try to transmit sound in something that doesn't support the linear sound, you try to break something that is not supposed to break. Same system, Z will be varied, and we'll try to break this network. You can break it either in compression or in tension. You could also do the same game which we did with a square lattice with braces. But the important point is that the starting point cannot be something like a triangular lattice. Because you not only want the physics of disorder that comes from the random insertion of braces, you also want the simultaneous going to zero of the elastic moduli. And in jamming, dz controls both. Okay? I'm going to show you also examples that don't have disorder, but still you can tune fracture not to happen by crack, simply by tuning what I call the fragility, which is a bad name, but just means that the solid is about to approach a point where the elastic moduli vanish. Let's not talk too much, just show a movie. So what we're going to see here is we're going to compress or stretch in later, and the local assignment is that whenever the tension exceeds a certain threshold, you break and you color in red. Okay? And the simulation is identical simulation MD from before. Okay?
And are the
thresholds the same? Threshold the same, because we want to play with the effect of rigidity on what I think Laurent would call the process zone, or the width of the crack. Okay, so here is the game. You see this, and you say, well, of course, it's a bit jiggled. There's a width to it, so it's not the classic picture from a textbook of a crack, which is the line. But it's a process stretching across the sample, more or less with a line-like character. Please notice that the naive picture of fracture mechanics in this system is deeply dangerous. The linear, I mean, at least for somebody as ignorant as I am, what I understand that the crack is in linear fracture mechanics is a line with an infinity at the tip in the stress. And that's why the process in that simple picture is controlled by the tip sequentially. But imagine a system like this, which has a mesoscopic length scale that can become infinitely larger at the critical point. It cannot support stress when that happens. The stress at the tip cannot be infinite anymore. In fact, it will be as large as the fluctuation of the stress all around. At that point, cracks cannot propagate in that sequential manner anymore. Another way of looking at it is, if you compress, and there is a zero energy degree of freedom that can shield the compression, then you will not break. How do we see that?
But controlling
that.
That Z is changing?
No. Here, it's changing in the sense that when you break the bonds, so delta Z parameterizes the system prior to breaking. During the breaking, you break bonds, and that's why at the end it stops, because it's become soft, and then you don't break it anymore. Now, let me show you the same thing as you try to break near this point. Okay? What you look at it, and you say, well, this thing looks a bit different to us from what we saw before. It's like isolated bond breaking. But how is this picture of isolated bond breaking connected to the running crack that we were seeing before? Either there is a transition in between, or this phenomena is really what we were seeing before, but from a different point of view. And I think it was very inspirational to hear Stefano's talk and read also the paper that Jim, Stefano, and their collaborators did, because they consider something that usually doesn't sound very grand, like finite size effective, but here is the essence. Why? Because you say, well, let's assume that you measure the width of this crack defined in the standard deviation of the points that break in the y direction. And you measure how that width varies with dz. That width will increase with this characteristic power law with a power of -1/2 until it saturates when the width becomes as big as the system size. And so if you happen to have a system that is here, that's to say, it happens to be a bit too small to see the running crack, then you will look at isolated bond breaking. But if you look at a bigger system, this is what you will see. And you will not know how to call this exactly. But if you zoom out even more, you will see that what you were calling isolated bond breaking is really the core or the width of the process zone of a crack. And that process zone goes to infinity at the critical point. So at the critical point, elasticity cannot win. Okay, but away from it, it can. And so if you want to make materials which are interesting, you can exploit this fact. And so we studied all the song and dance in great detail. I think I'm approaching the time where I should stop, so I'll approach faster. We did it also for system off lattice. But one thing you can see is that there is a simple way of rescaling all that data. If you plot the width versus the system size. And if you plot the width versus system size, there's two regimes. If you're below a critical length scale L star, below which the system is floppy, the width can scale only linearly with L, and it's isolated bond breaking. Above it, you see developing this running crack, whose width grows super diffusively and with an exponent very close to optimal random path, but also with this broadening factors. And the picture that you have here, the reason why this is a two-thirds and not a one-half, or close to two-thirds and not a one-half, is because the picture is what Laurent was describing. Directed path controlled by damage coalescence. That's why the crack doesn't go back, because it will find its try to find its optimal path. And the scaling of this exponent is close to delta z to the minus 3/2. It's not exactly 3/2, because this is not exactly two-thirds. It's related to the fractal dimension of the cracking objects in a way that I doubt I can show you. And there's this beautiful picture of a blob that is very reminiscent of the pinkest blob in polymer physics. I have no time to cover this. If you're interested, you can ask me. What I want to show in one extra minute is the thing with Sid and Michelle. So in this part of the talk, you can ask a question that we explored, which is delta z is just a parameter that you cook up because you chose all these systems. But delta z is a proxy for vanishing elasticity. In jamming, delta z is just proportional to g over b. And so what Michel did, he said, why don't I take an honeycomb lattice, which has bond bending, clearly is not parameterized by delta z, doesn't even have to be disordered, and I just change the ratio of the strut width over strut length, which is a way of controlling the fragility parameter going to zero. And when she did that, and of course, I mean, you can do for two purposes. One is sort of in terms of fundamental understanding. The other is to engineer metamaterials with tunable failure property, which is also interesting to me, at least. And what she found is that the same, so this is her experiment, just snapshot. This is high G over B. This is low G over B. A low G over B is the fracture is delocalized. At high G over B, you see the running crack. These are our simulations. And one thing that is really cool, when you try to make those plots, both in experiment and simulation, you find that the characteristic length scale, where the crossover between the two happens, which goes to infinity at the fragility point where g is equal to zero, scales with same exponent in all of the system that we have tried, which is a hint of universality in this context, and is the last thing that I would like to tell you. And thank you very much for your attention.
So an experimentalist might or might not have an easy time watching the front, but I know that if you have an ideal system and you start shearing at some velocity, you get a constant stress that's related to the modulus times the velocity over the speed of sound. By monitoring something like that, which would be a surface property, can you determine anything about the other parameters you've measured?
Yeah, that would be another way to do it. But the comment about experimentalists not being able to see the front is something on which I would like to leave the stage for Zhao Ping in the afternoon to give you a couple of ideas how that's not necessarily crazy. And there are some contexts in which it may be the only thing that you can do if the speed at which the front propagates is ultra slow. So. Go on.
Yes, I have a comment on the fracture part. So it's actually a known strategy to try to increase your process zone as much as possible to reach the system size. And this strategy is based on what you explained us to avoid the formation of a crack and crack propagation. And and your way to, in biological system, a possible way is to reduce system size to reach an intrinsic process zone size that is defined by the material parameter. In your case, you manipulate this process zone size by tuning your material properties and putting it close to the rigidity point. Another strategy will be also to tune the disorder. Absolutely. The more you increase it.
And I think the people in the audience who have just done that.
And I was wondering, also, somehow taking bones out is also having some disorder in your system. Is there any connection between
absolutely.
These both
strategies? My impression is that actually the disorder aspect, for example, if you take a normal network, like a triangular lattice that is not about to crash, or even a random fuse model, there's a lot of references there in the slides that I didn't show to some of the work of Stefan and others here. It's actually more a little bit more explored. But what I wanted to show is that there was also this elasticity aspect. The second thing is that, you see, when we first started, at least my own motivation when I started looking at this problem was that I wanted to learn something about a transition that looks like a sort of glass transition. And I wanted to see whether I could pick up a divergent length scale from doing a mechanics experiment that entailed either propagating sound and looking at the width or breaking them and see that length scale popping out in front of your very own eyes. And that perhaps is a less practical motivation from the point of view of design of materials, but it's still one that's appealing and perhaps has some intellectual value to it.
Very nice presentation. Can we apply these technologies, look at the cyclic loading, fatigue loading, would that be possible?
I have no clue. Sorry. I have no knowledge of at the moment that would enable me to answer that question.
Vincenzo, when the I think you've done these simulations, when the single particle's spring constant becomes nonlinear, can you get any coupling of that nonlinear to the sort of nonlinear sound speed? Like, do you get any? Is there anything interesting that happens when you do the nonlinear single speed?
Absolutely. In fact, the nonlinear part is the one that's been explored extensively, even by Vitali and others. There, the velocity of propagation of the shock, though, is not dictated by the nonlinear stress-strain relationship, but is dictated by the nonlinear elasticity at the two particle levels. So, for example, if you have Hertzian interactions, then the velocity of the front depends on the coefficient, on the exponent of the Hertzian interaction. So to me, that would be a local mechanism of nonlinearity, whereas here there's something a bit.
Okay. All right. So I have a question regarding the last slide you showed. If you change the width and the length of the in your honeycomb lattice, you actually get to different fracture result. That is actually interesting because the D over B is proportional to the Poisson's ratio, right? Yeah. But if you look at your result, if you let the D over B getting smaller, you get a brittle fracture.
Yeah.
And you let it getting bigger, you get the diffusive fracture.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That actually is a little bit different, very different from what you see from real systems. In real materials, it's just opposite. I'm wondering,
yeah, this is something that you see in metamaterials, though, where you can engineer the Poisson ratio.
Right, you can determine it, you can see it. I'm just wondering whether or not this result is coming from your model because you use the nearest neighbor, one directional spring model. You don't include the bond.
No, the bond bending is not.
Bond bending.
No, the bond
into it.
No, I think what's peculiar is that you have to work near this elastic instability. And of course, where this elastic instability lies, where you lose your moduli, depends on the local interaction. For example, if you had bond bending, this ZC equal 4 is not the correct critical point.
Right.
It's shifted lower because there's more constraints. But even in that system, you can have it. And in fact, this is pretty much something that we see, and we've done it even with things with beams that can bend.
So the beam bending is different from, for example, I have a continuous interaction.
So one thing that here it's used is short range. The interactions are short range.
Right. If I extend my interaction, my spring constant to second or third neighbor, that would actually change the picture.
Right, a little bit. Actually, this is an issue that has been studied also in the jamming context. Namely, if you go beyond short-range forces and include the other ones, what happens?
Right.
And the answer is, as you already guessed, is that if it falls sufficiently sharply with distance, and whatever you're neglecting is a perturbation, then you just smooth away a bit the picture, but the physics is still there. Of course, if this interaction was flat, and even the very far away guys would interact as strongly as the one that's close to you, then this isn't lost.
Right. You already defined your instability by delta z equals 4, and that's the log of instability.
But notice, the general way at the end I emphasized is to think about as g over b. So if you can find the material where you can tune that ratio, then you will know automatically that there's this shielding mechanism. Because you try to compress it, there's another deformation that can absorb the compression and prevents the break.
Sure.
If you can engineer that with whatever way you want, then you're in this realm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Vincenzo, this exponent that you see must be related to the L delta Z relationship close to the jamming.
It's not the cut, the one-half one is not the cutting.
But I'm saying it should depend if that exponent changed, correct?
If
the exponent...
No, let me show you. So actually, this is one of the things, please tell me if I understand it correctly. What you're saying is that there is this L star that I'm defining, mm-hmm. which has this peculiar mm-hmm. power mm-hmm. that doesn't seem to be the minus one that we know or some other ones that we know.
But is it related to that?
It's related. Actually, this is the slide about.
Right.
So this is a bit of attempt at the slide, but let me run it through you. If you do the argument that, for example, Mathieu has done before, you say, well, you started with an extra number of bonds, that is L to the D times delta Z. Mm-hmm. And now, so the original argument of Mathieu is that you cut a face,
right.
and then you cut L to the D minus 1.
Right.
But now the difference between what he was doing and this problem is that in what he was doing, Mathieu chooses how to cut. Mm-hmm. In what we're doing here, the crack chooses. And the crack, with impunity, decides to choose a different dimension from Mathieu, and if that dimension would be a fractal object. The crack is a fractal object. So the number of broken bonds goes like L to the power of D to the F. But you can still balance the two, and what you get is L star that goes like delta Z to 1 over this quantity here. This quantity is geometry and spatial dimension. There's a nice paper by Stefano and some of his collaborators where some of these things were measured. It happens to be close to the 2/3, not exactly 2/3. When you stick this in here, you find the scaling that is very close to what we're seeing.
Understood. So my question was, like Tom and Sean, who's sitting back there, they have looked at all of these lattices, which are isostatic, but that Mathieu's exponent is not fixed by delta Z. So what I'm wondering is, you can have isostatic lattices, and Xiaoming, you should correct me if I'm wrong. You can create special isostatic lattices where the L doesn't go as one of the delta Z.
Right.
So I'm wondering if you could look at fracturing those, and if this exponent goes.
So notice that there's a second exponent, E or 2. In fact, even in studies of jamming, you have typically two exponents. One is 1 over delta Z, and 1 over delta Z to the 1/2. In fact, including some of the recent work in mean field of Mathieu. The second, 1 over delta Z to 1/2, is a measure of disorder. Notice that here, there is this length scale.
I was talking about
lattice. No, but even the lattice has extra bonds put, okay? In the lattices too, you see here, there's a second quantity that you see, which is delta Z to the 1/2 appearing in the width, which is a second measure. So one of the things that we have here when we go from the jamming system to this system is that, to say, a square lattice with braces that Xiaoming and company studied for the vibrational modes, for example, is that the ratio G over B does not depend anymore on delta Z linearly. But if I'm not mistaken, for the square lattice, it goes like delta Z squared. And if you try the Kagome, there's another scaling. And one of the things that we tried to check our logic is we picked up lattices where G over B is flat. Then we should not see any of the scaling that we expect. And exactly that's what we signed. And that's why you have to use the honeycomb and not the triangle incident.
Okay, let's thank the judges. Lunch is served. We're going to be back here at 2 o'clock.